Hi, this is Chris from PleasureMechanics.com. Welcome to the Speaking of Sex podcast. This week we have a very special guest here to talk about a topic that affects millions of people but is rarely discussed. Before we start, I want to remind you that you can find a complete podcast archive over at PleasureMechanics.com, where you can also be in touch with us if you have any questions or topics you'd like to hear covered on future episodes of this podcast. Now I'd like to welcome our guest, Joellen Naughty. Joellen runs the website redheadbedhead.com, writes for a variety of websites, and travels the country teaching sex workshops. As education coordinator and lead sex educator for the Portland Academy of Sex Education and co-emissary of Sex Geekdom Portland, love that, Joellen works to prove that through constant learning, nonstop dialogue, and frequent wiseassery, we can save the world from mediocre sex. Joellen, welcome to Speaking of Sex.
Thank you.
Let's start at the beginning. How did you become the redhead bedhead?
Oh, goodness. So in the middle of, well, I guess actually the beginning of 2011, I woke up in a sexless marriage and realized that I was in the completely wrong life. So I kind of scrapped it and started over. Wow. And I always joke that I kind of did a overcorrect and tried to fix it by sleeping with all of Boston. And realized I was having a lot of sex, but still felt like I didn't know things and felt like I was on the outside of the world of sex, and it was more for a thing that was for other people and a thing that other people understood and a thing that still scared me a lot. And in 2012, I decided I wanted to learn a lot of stuff, and I was at the same time having a massive career crisis, and I knew I wanted to write things. And I wanted to teach people things. And all at once I decided that what I wanted to do was go on this mission to learn everything I could about sex. And while I did that, I was going to write everything I learned down so other people could learn it with me.
I love that. You shared your journey as you went.
Exactly. To me, the funny part of all this was, you know, I've since traveled conferences and really gotten to know this world, and I've met all these people who spend all this time learning and traveling to these things and then eventually say, you know, okay, now that I know all this stuff and I've been here a while, I'm going to start a site or I'm going to start a podcast. And I always say I did it backwards.
Yeah.
Because I had no idea this world existed. I thought I was doing this super novel thing by writing about sex on the internet. And so I dove in and then found this amazing world of people who were writing and talking and learning and teaching. And it was like I found Narnia. It was wonderful, and I've been here ever since.
And can you isolate one or two major lessons that you learned along your journey that changed how you feel about sex or optimized your sex life in some way?
A big one for me that's kind of the opposite of everything I learned growing up was that sex is collaborative.
Mm.
I was brought up to think of, to think of everything as very binary, you know, very male and female, and that that I was always very much in danger, and that men were the adversaries, and I had to protect myself because they were always trying to get sex. And it never occurred to me until I was in my 30s that sex was something I could enjoy with my partner versus something I, you know, begrudgingly engaged in. And that was like this massive light bulb moment.
So let's dive in. So on an article on bitchmedia.com, you write this. Imagine for a moment that I took away your ability to enjoy sex. It's just gone. Now, in order to get it back, you would have to declare that you belong to two categories of people who are regularly stigmatized in pop culture. While you are dealing with this, you may also be experiencing feelings of worthlessness, guilt, hopelessness, lethargy, anxiety, and an inability to concentrate. If you can get past all of that and reach out for help, there's a big chance no one will do anything. They may not even believe you. Welcome to the world of a woman dealing with the sexual side effects of depression and its treatment. That is just beautifully put and brings us to the topic of today's podcast, sex and depression. You're writing a book on this subject, so tell us, why did you initiate research into sex and depression?
When I started my site, I was writing about everything that was going on for me because it didn't occur to me not to. Mm. And I had an experience. I'd been on antidepressants for years, and I was given a new drug, and it took away my libido and my ability to orgasm. Mm. And I recognized it immediately. And it also made me very lethargic. And I caught all of these things right away. And so I took myself off the drug, and I wrote about the experience. And I wrote about how I recognized that this was what had happened to me years ago when I didn't understand, and what that meant for a previous relationship and all of these things. And I just posted it, and I didn't think anything of it. I didn't think anybody but my mom was reading at that point. And that was when I started getting emails and messages and all of these people reaching out and saying, you know, that happened to me too. I know what that feels like. And what struck me about all the reaching out was so much of it was done not in my comments field, not on Twitter, not publicly. Mm-hmm. It was all done kind of in secret, in ways that nobody else could see, because it's this stigmatized thing still. So many people don't feel comfortable admitting that they're dealing with sexual dysfunction, as it were, mental health issues, or if they've tried to deal with those, they've been kind of swatted away. Hmm.
Am I right to hear that you recognize the effects of this drug because you were orgasmic and enjoying sexuality, and then you noticed the contrast? And if you hadn't been orgasmic, you might not have identified it. Is that right?
So I was orgasmic to the extent that I am. Uh-huh. I always say that I've never explored my sexuality not on some form of antidepressant. Uh-huh. So when people talk about, I was on a panel last year with a woman who kept saying, you know, my orgasms were like the beginning and the end of the universe, and it was and I had no idea what she was talking about. Because my orgasms are kind of like a very small surprise party where like one guy pops up with a balloon and is like, hey, but you know, they're my orgasms and I know them. And at the time that this experience happened, I was 1 month into owning my first Hitachi. Mm-hmm. And so I was really into that experience. And when that was failing me, and when I looked at that failing me, and realized that in addition to that not working, I hadn't had the desire to use it in a week, mm-hmm. which at that point was weird, I kind of put together that something was seriously up.
Yeah. And so how do we separate the effects of depression itself versus the antidepressant medications? Is there any way to sort through that and think about the different effects of the depression versus the medications?
So I did a survey last year where we surveyed 1,100 people on their experience with sex and depression, and then we did more in-depth interviews with 20 people. And the mistake I made in the survey is that I bought into what I call the lie of sex and depression, which is that depressed people don't want to have sex anyway. So I didn't really ask. I think there's one question where we talk about the symptoms of your depression, and we mention, you know, lower libido or something. But we didn't really ask about how just depression impacted people's sexuality. In the interviews, we asked that, and people got to talk about it. And what was fascinating was hearing the different responses, because they weren't what we expected. For about a quarter, maybe a third of the people reported an increase in sexual activity, in libido, when they were untreated and dealing with depression. And some of it came from using sex as an escape, using sex as self-harm, using sex to feel something. And some of it just came from, you know, a change in personality. So it was completely unexpected to us, because we had bought into the idea that depression comes with, you know, lethargy and not wanting to have sex. So that made us look a little bit more closely at kind of separating out what the different feelings are between the loss of libido versus the just the feelings that come with depression. Mm-hmm. So I talk a lot to people about, when you're dealing with depression, making conscious decisions when it comes to sex. And that involves a process. I always talk about wishing there was a checklist we could have that keeps us from kind of desexualizing ourselves. Because I know I did it at one point, dealing with depression. I said, you know what? I'm of course I don't want to have sex. I'm depressed, or I'm on antidepressants. And with my last bout, I used myself kind of as an experiment, because my last episode happened while I was doing this survey. Mm. So it was great. It was actually great timing.
A living laboratory.
I got to experiment on myself. And I played with this exercise I talk about, this like conscious decision-making when it came to sex. Because by checking in, you get to stop and see, well, why don't I want to have sex right now, right? And ask yourself the question, like, okay, so right now, sex feels like a demand, and I can't handle demands right now. Hmm. And so maybe that's a time when you don't push ahead on the sex thing. But then there are times where I would check in, I'd say, okay, well, actually, sex does sound good. I just really don't want to get up off the couch. Or, you know, I'm getting caught up in the idea of, like, but then I'd have to change my clothes. And and I would notice that, okay, maybe those were the times I was going down the depression rabbit hole, and I could reel myself back in and come back to sex. And that was what I found was the benefit of the kind of the conscious decisions when it comes to sex. The taking yourself out of the feeling that by its nature, depression comes with no sex, and realizing that depression impacts all of these aspects of our lives, and with that comes ways it can impact sex. Does that make sense? I feel like I just babbled for a long time.
No, it makes perfect sense. And I'm thinking about the ways that these kind of consciously checking in about your feelings and thoughts about sex might also be a tool within a relationship, and how couples can deal with depression if one or both of them have it. Like, what advice do you have for partners if their partner is depressed, how do they approach sexuality without being demanding, without being needy and supporting their partner, but also taking care of their own needs? Do you have any thoughts on that?
It's a big shift that's actually happened in writing the book, because I joke that the book started off as giving people tangible proof to hold up for other people to say, like, see this experience I'm having. Mm. Other people are having this too. This book says so.
Yeah.
And I realized along the way, partially by having my own episode while working on it and having a partner who'd never dealt with depression, how much partners need resources, and how a lot of the resources out there right now set up this dynamic where it's the partner who's dealing with depression and their depression on one side and the other partner on the other.
Mm-hmm.
And what I would like to see is setting up a dynamic where we put both partners kind of on one side and the depression on the other side. Sounds wrong, but the depression there, I just want to put the partners together.
That they're working as a team.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so I talk a lot about giving partners a common language. The thing I reference constantly when I speak about this is something called spoon theory. And this was created by a woman who runs a website called butyoudon'tlooksick.com. And she has lupus, I believe. And she uses spoons to explain to her friend, like, how you have a budget of energy, you know, ability to get through a day. And when you're out of spoons, you can't do any more that day. And teaching that to my partner gave him kind of a language to deal with what I was going through that he didn't have before.
Mm-hmm.
And so something I'm working on is creating a toolbox for partners that helps them learn kind of not to... There's a lot out there that tells partners kind of what to do for their partners. I would like to help them figure out kind of what questions to ask and how to hold space and how to be there together.
Beautiful. Yes. One of the things we talk about is the difference between rejection and refusal, and how rejection can feel like this very personal attack, whereas refusal is just saying, that's not what I can do right now. I don't have the resources for that. And it's not a personal attack. Mm-hmm. And that sounds like a important tool in this, so the partner doesn't feel like they personally are being rejected, but that it's just not something that's on the table at that moment. I'm curious, we're talking about this and we're using sex as this term as if we all know what that means. And, you know, often when we think about sex, it's full on intercourse and the whole shebang. Mm-hmm. How important do you think it is to prioritize other kinds of touch and affection, massage, over the pressure of sexual performance and make those options for connection?
Oh, I think that's hugely important. I think people get so hung up on this idea that people are competitive by nature. And we have this, and I'm assigning this to everybody now because I just am. But we have this idea that, you know, everybody is having all this sex and everybody's having better sex than we are. And sex is all the orgasms. And if we're not doing that, we're somehow failing at all the sex. And so much, it would be so much easier, calmer, less stressful for people if we could just reframe sex and pleasure and connection and realize that you can have all of those things without always having, you know, full-on intercourse with all of these screaming orgasms and all of the things that media tells you sex is.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we know that massage and affectionate touch releases oxytocin. Is there a way that touch can, I don't want to say be a cure for depression, of course, but that can help alleviate some of the symptoms, like in your experience and in your conversations with people? Is that oxytocin release from affectionate touch useful and beneficial? Like, is that something that's felt?
Well, I think it depends on where each individual person is at.
Uh-huh.
I think there are those times where people are in that moment where they kind of can't with the touching.
Uh-huh.
One of the things I've talked about in the past is sometimes when we're really kind of in it, we shut ourselves off to the idea that we deserve things that feel nice.
Mm.
Right? And I've talked in the past about starting the word I'm looking for, the idea of sensual feeling and pleasurable feeling, even starting it with something as simple as a blanket that feels really good, mm-hmm. or a hot bath, and letting that be kind of your doorway in.
Mm-hmm.
And not doing it with agenda, but just remembering that you deserve things that feel good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I hear from you and others that different medications for depression have different side effects for different people. And I've heard from some of our listeners who have written that they're nervous or anxious to go to their doctors and talk to them about their sex life and make their libido a priority. Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts on how you can approach this topic and kind of self-advocate for experimenting with different medications if the libido is something you want to relook at?
So it is tricky because doctors do not get a ton of training when it comes to sex, especially if their specialty does not involve genitals. That is what I've learned in my research. And one never knows how their specific doctor will react. But it is, I think the best thing we can do is tell our doctors what is important to us.
Mm-hmm.
So that they know. And the thing about side effects is the drugs do all hit people differently. And it's why one of the big things I warn against when people write about this topic is medication recommending.
Yeah.
Because the internet is full of people saying, you know, this one is what, you know, saved my sex drive, and this one kills it, and this one, and our bodies all work so differently that what, you know, makes your body function so much better might kill my libido. And then because I listened to you and believed that that medication is supposed to fix it, I now feel extra broken.
Right.
So I think we all need to remember that it is an experimental thing. You have to play with the drugs, as weird as that sounds, and advocate for yourself. Even though I know when you're dealing with depression, talking about advocating for yourself sounds like the hardest thing ever.
Hmm.
And if your doctor really isn't listening to you, again, I know this sounds so hard, find a doctor who does. One of the most interesting things, though, that I found in the survey is, you know, we found a lot that people weren't talking to their doctors about sex and depression. But when we looked at the why, half of it was negative experiences with doctors, and half of it was a preconceived notion that doctors just didn't care. But it wasn't based on an experience. It was just, I don't think my doctor would care about this. So I think we need to give doctors a bit more of the chance to care.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe be surprised by their compassion.
Exactly.
So we recently got an email from a listener, and I just want to read you a clip from it and see how you respond. So this listener is dealing with infertility, and so there's already some pressure on their sex life. And so she says, partly to combat the depression from not being able to become parents, my husband currently takes an SSRI for depression, which sometimes causes delay orgasm, lack of orgasm, or orgasm without pleasure for him. One of the reasons I myself am not on an antidepressant is the devastating impact they often have on female sexuality. What do you think about the role of antidepressants in our sex lives? How can men and women keep from having their sex drives erased or the pleasure sucked out of their life when taking SSRIs? Do you have any recommendation for this listener?
Oh.
Beyond all the wise advice we've covered.
Oh, goodness. I tried to tread so lightly here because I am not a doctor. But I also always want people to remember to stay open to all the possibilities we have that go beyond SSRIs, right? So there are different families of drugs that don't come with the same devastating, you know, impact. So if you find that a certain kind of drug is hitting you in a certain way, there is the you do have the ability to talk to your doctor about a different kind of drug, because something that some of the people who took the survey did talk about was taking drugs that were known for their sexual side effects, but having the drug work so well as an antidepressant that they ended up happier and thus kind of coming back to themselves as a person and a sexual being. So if the drug is not working terribly well as an antidepressant and it's giving you the sexual side effects, there are so many other options to explore.
This is that moment for that conversation with the doctor.
But, you know, one of my colleagues is on a drug that devastated her ability to orgasm, but it is, she says it's the first time in her life she hasn't had suicidal thoughts. So she's staying with the drug, and she's exploring super high-powered toys, right? Because they are a thing that kind of gets through through the kind of deadened nerves and makes her able to feel. And so she's kind of finding the hacks around what the drug is doing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Stay alive first.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the things we talk about with couples is that there are all these different facets to a relationship. There's the sexual side, the romantic side, the friendship side, the partner in life side. And so is it important to continue investing as a couple in all of these different facets of a relationship, even if the sex life isn't the one that you most want, or if it's lying dormant for a while? Are there strategies for couples to stay strong as a couple during depressive states?
I do believe that there absolutely are. I am a big advocate for constantly checking in on the sexual state of things, because I think one of the big dangers about of the sex and depression situation is when we fall into that trap of letting of believing that the depression is running our sexual show, right? And so we say, you know, I don't want to have sex because of the depression, because of the antidepressants. and we stop checking in, there is always the possibility that one day we'll emerge from whatever's going on there and our libido will come back or our sexual response will come back and we'll realize that it does not, it has not come back in relation to our partner. Right? And that's why I am a very big advocate for constantly checking in on the sexual piece, even if you're not pursuing the sexual piece actively. Right? So keeping the relationship strong in all of the other regards, not pressuring the sexual piece if that's not happening, but constantly checking in and making the conscious choices with it. Is this still a partner you would want to have if sex was a thing that was happening for you right now?
Yeah. Is there anything else you think is essential for our listeners to know about sex and depression?
I think that there is a certain degree of ableism that goes on in general with people who are any form of not able-bodied, not able-minded, not anything less than, or not less than, anything, anything other than 100% like good to go as far as, you know, the world is concerned. And so we desexualize them, right? We think that people dealing with mental illness just don't have a sexuality. And I've seen that carried over into advice that is out in the world. I phone am non-monogamous, and I keep reading articles that say, you know, don't engage in non-monogamy if you're dealing with any kind of, you know, mental issues, because you can't bring that to the table. And that is part of a lot of people's lives. And when we tell people that, you know, we're basically confiscating your sex card until you until you get your act together, that's, you know, we wouldn't tell people that, you know, until you stop having diabetes, you're not allowed to have sex. Right? Depression is something that a lot of people are living with and are living with chronically. And we need to kind of learn how to navigate that. And we need to be honest with ourselves, because being in a relationship with somebody with depression is not something everybody can do. But we're not going to figure that out unless we start kind of learning what that means in terms of relating to one another, to navigating the ins and outs of it, and to actually talking about it.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having this conversation and taking on this topic with such compassion and grace. Your book is going to be really vital for so many people. When can we expect that out?
So right now, my goals right now
are... It's a loaded question for an author.
I keep my goals modest. So right now, my goal is to finish the book by the end of this year. So we'll see. We're keeping the goals modest at this point.
Always wise. And in the meantime, how can our listeners find you to learn more?
You can find me online at redheadbedhead.com. You can find me on Twitter at Joellen Naughty. Just my whole name. And on Facebook at The Redhead Bedhead.
Beautiful. Beautiful. And we will link that all up on the show notes page for this podcast episode over at pleasuremechanics.com. Joellen, thank you so much for this conversation, and I look forward to more with you.
Thank you so much for having me.